Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Proverbs chapter 27, which I will entitle Proverbs of Solomon, part 18. We begin in verse 1. Solomon says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth." Nobody knows the future, but people love to talk about, "Oh, I'm going to get rich. This is going to be great tomorrow." James 4:13 says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. You don't even know what tomorrow will bring, what your life will be. For you are like smoke that appears for a little while, then vanishes." James's exhortation in James 4 and Proverbs 27:1 are really applicable to politicians who promise no inflation, jobs for everybody. We'll take care of the pandemic. Yeah, right. You don't know what today's going to bring forth. It's amazing how cocky politicians are about how they're going to fix things. Most of what happens to us, well, everything that happens to us is determined by God. There are some penultimate circumstances that we are responsible for, of course. But ultimately, God's going to decide, not politicians. We go to Proverbs 27, verse 2. Solomon says, "Let another praise you, and not your own mouth, a stranger, and not your own lips." Paul says the same thing to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 10:18, "For it is not he who commends himself that is approved, but he whom the Lord commends." Now that's talking about bragging about yourself. You shouldn't do that, but sometimes you need to commend yourself in order to defend yourself against unjust attacks. For example, this is a part of Samuel's final speech to the Israelites. Samuel says, "Here I am. Bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? I will restore it to you." This is from Samuel's final speech after Israel had asked for a king, and Samuel's trying to say, "Look, I served you as a judge. I didn't do anything wrong. And so you're wrong in asking for a king." So he's trying to make a point. He's not trying to brag about himself. He's trying to make a point that the Israelites are sinning in asking for a king. How about Paul, who's trying to defend his apostleship? He writes to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 11:12, "But what I am doing, I will continue to do so," i.e. boasting, "so that I may cut off opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the matter about which they are boasting." In other words, he's going to shut the mouth of these cocky apostles who are trying to take Paul's place. Well, he had to brag about himself. But notice as he talked about it, if you read the context, he's sort of embarrassed about having to boast about himself. But he's got to defend his God-given apostleship. And so he has to brag about himself. But he's really bragging about what God has done in him. It's not selfish bragging. Now this proverb, "Let another praise you and not your own mouth," contradicts an American proverb. If you don't toot your own horn, nobody else will. You've heard that before. I don't think the American proverb is inspired by God by any means of the imagination. Proverbs 27:3. Solomon says, "A stone is heavy and the sand weighty, but the provocation of a fool is heavier than both of them." Solomon does not suffer fools gladly. We've read so many proverbs that he has written blasting fools. I won't read you any more. I will look at a minor issue here. "A stone is heavy and the sand weighty." I don't know why the article is there. The NIV, the Holman Christian Study Bible, the NAB, the Young's Lateral Translation, the Bible in Basic English, and God's Word Translation all omit the article. The KJV and the ASV and the NASB put the article "the" there. Why? "A stone is heavy and the sand," meaning all the sand in the world. I don't know. Doesn't matter. The point is, a stone is heavy and sand is heavy, but they don't compare to the heaviness of the provocations of a fool. We go now to Proverbs 27:4. "Wrath is fierce and anger is a flood, but who can stand before jealousy?" Here's some other scriptures inveighing against jealousy. James 3:14. "But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth." Bitter jealousy. Two verses later in James 3, verse 16, "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing." That verse is good for all of you who like to engage in church politics. Proverbs 6:34, "For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance," especially men who have had other men seduce their wives. Ooh, that's bad business. I remember a man had that happen to him at a church down the road from me, and he shows up at the church with a loaded gun and fired away. Fortunately, nobody was killed, but it could have been bad. Now, here's some scriptural examples of jealousy. Cain was jealous of Abel because God took Abel's sacrifices and rejected Cain. So what did Cain do as a result of his jealousy? He killed Abel, killed his own brother. How about Joseph's brothers? They were jealous of him because their father favored Joseph. And so what did the brothers of Joseph do? They kidnapped Joseph and sold him into captivity. How about the Jews? Were they jealous of Jesus? Yes, Jesus was saying he was the king of the Jews. And the Pharisees were jealous because their teaching was not heeded nearly as much as Jesus's was. And so what do the Pharisees, as well as the Sadducees, what do? They kill Jesus. Jealousy is an awful thing. I like these stories of where a man will look at his girlfriend and she's torn between him and another man, and he finally says, if the other guy's better for you and you'll be more happy with him because I love you, I want you to go to him. Whoa, that's the very opposite of jealousy. We go now to Proverbs 27, verses 5 and 6. Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Now, what does open rebuke mean? Does it mean public rebuke, or does it mean that one's heart is open and openly rebukes a friend? Well, it's not open rebuke in public. Jesus said that rebuke among friends should be done in private, Matthew 18:15. If your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. That's the first stage in the stages of church discipline, a private rebuke. So I don't think that's what it means. Better is public rebuke. Better is open rebuke means that a friend, instead of hiding his rebuke in his heart, he openly tells his friend, this is what the problem is. As John Gill said, reproof given faithfully and plainly, with openness of heart and without mincing the matter and palliating the offense, but speaking out freely and faithfully laying before a person the evil of his sin and all the circumstances of it, as the Apostle Paul did to Peter when he withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed. That's a good example. The great Apostle Peter, the first pope, if you will excuse the expression, one of the leaders of the church at Jerusalem, and here Paul says, no, Peter, you're a hypocrite. You're not eating with the Gentiles. Adam Clark says of open rebuke, it is a rough medicine, and none can desire it. Well, of course it's a rough medicine, but it's medicine. Medicine makes you better. Here's some other proverbs. Proverbs 28:23, Solomon says, he who rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with the tongue. Proverbs 9:8-9, do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase his learning. So this open rebuke of a friend is better than love that is concealed. This is what John Gill says about concealed love. Such love to a person as will not suffer him to tell him of his faults, for fear of grieving him or losing his friendship, or than such love as does not show itself in deeds, and particularly in faithful reproofs, for so to act is to hate a person and suffer sin to be upon him. And that's absolutely true, and Gill backs up his statement by quoting Leviticus, or citing Leviticus 19:17, which says, you shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. So it's not a sin to reprove your neighbor. In fact, it's a meritorious deed to do so. Verse 6 says, faithful are the wounds of a friend. That's similar to what David said in Psalms 141, verse 5, first part of the verse. Let the righteous smite me in kindness and reprove me. It is oil upon the head. Do not let my head refuse it. So David certainly did remind the rebuke from a friend. He welcomed it, said it was like oil on his head. Of course, oil on your head was oil that was put into the hair to dress it, to clean it, a pleasant thing back then in that culture. Solomon ends up verse 6 by saying, deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. What kiss does that remind us of? Judas, who kissed Jesus at the Last Supper. having already sold him out for 30 pieces of silver. So, this proverb says that it's much better to be wounded by an honest friend than kissed by a deceitful enemy. We go down to Proverbs 27, verse 7. A sated man loathes honey, but to a famished man any bitter thing is sweet. Sated, of course, means you've filled up to the brim and can't handle any more. If you've eaten a bunch of honey, the thought of eating one more tablespoon of honey, or even one more molecule of honey, makes you nauseated. To apply this, John Gill says that if a man has many things of this world, he often is not interested in spiritual things. Although that's true, I'm not exactly sure that's what Solomon meant. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that this proverb means that the luxury of wealth confers less happiness than the healthy appetite of labor. I don't think that that's what this proverb means either. I think that Solomon was just trying to express the economic principle of marginal utility. I remember in economics class I had reading a textbook, and the textbook gave an example of decreasing marginal utility. Marginal means if you have 99 oranges, the marginal orange is the 100th orange, the one that's on the edge, the last one. Its utility decreases because you're sick to death of the other 99 oranges. That's the same thing that Solomon is saying here. If you have 99 tablespoons of honey, the 100th one is going to make you loathe it. And of course, I think the ultimate aim of this proverb is to show that material things, sooner or later, have a diminishing marginal utility. You're not going to be happy. Think of all these billionaires. What are you going to spend all that money on? But on the other hand, to a famished man, any bitter thing is sweet. So people who are poor, they appreciate a good meal, shelter, clothing. So think about that the next time you want to get rich. We go down to Proverbs 27, verse 8. Like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is a man who wanders from his home. Now let's look at the wandering bird first. Why would a bird wander from her nest? A couple of options. One option is the bird wants to get food. Thus, the bird will expose her young to danger. She leaves her birds behind to go get food. Or it could be the bird is wandering because the bird is on migration, going from one home to the next, going from a winter home to a summer home. The Benson and Pulpit commentators say that a bird that wanders from her nest is exposed to fowlers and to birds of prey, and so it's dangerous to wander from home. Well, for whatever reason, we'll just assume that the bird is not staying at home in her nest, and we'll look at now the man who wanders from his home. A couple of options on what that means. Gill and Clark suggest that a man in times of famine or distress will go far away to find food for his family. And that's true. But that's in times of distress. Adam Clark says that God's general advice is, do good and dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. In other words, stay home. The Ellicott and Pulpit commentators say that it's not really famine or distress, but it's rather a man who's lost his home and gone into exile because of military or political persecution for whatever reason. Well, for whatever reason the bird wanders or the man wanders, we need to know what the point of the proverb is. And I would say that the point of the proverb can be explained by an English proverb. There's no place like home. The Pulpit commentator says, quote, the love of Orientals for their native soil is a passion which no sordid and miserable surroundings can extinguish. In other words, home might be nasty, might be a hut, but it's still home. Okay, well, if that's the point of the proverb, there's no place like home, what's the big deal about that proverb? The Pulpit commentator gives another explanation of the meaning of the proverb. That commentary says that people who are constantly flitting about are not successful. And the Pulpit commentary uses an English proverb to explain that. A rolling stone gathers no moss. Well, I never knew what that proverb meant in English. I never did understand why people would say a rolling stone gathers no moss, except they would say that this person is a wanderer. And of course, there are tons of wanderers in modern day life because it's so much easier to travel. But it is true that when you wander and wander and wander, you're not really building up success at home. In fact, if you think about most wanderers, they don't have a lot of money. My wife's father, who is now deceased, but during the Depression, he rode trains illegally. He was basically a hobo, and he did it for years. To be honest with you, I kind of admired him. He was a rolling stone, and he gathered no moss because he didn't have a lot of money. by the time I got to meet him, when he was an elderly gentleman, he was near his end. But he raised two nice daughters. I married one of them. He did okay. But why? Because he settled down and became a mechanic and knew what he was doing. But while he was wandering around on freight trains, he wasn't exactly gathering any moss. So I think that what Solomon is saying is stick to the knitting, as the old management guru used to say. Stick to your knitting. Do what you're good at. Stick to it and don't flit from job to job. This proverb convicts me because I've had more jobs than a dog has fleas, and it has hurt. There's no question about it. So if you feel like you haven't seen the world, and if you haven't traveled enough to gain life experiences, and you're just bored with your job at home, that's easy to feel that way. Just remember, you're gathering moss. You're not wandering from your nest, and you are probably being successful. We go down to Proverbs 27:9. Solomon says, "Oil and perfume make the heart glad, so a man's counsel is sweet to his friend." Oil would be olive oil, and perfume is sometimes translated as incense. Here are some other translations. The God's Word translation and the NAB translate this as perfume and incense. The oil is incense. The Holman Christian Study Bible says oil and incense, so the perfume is incense. KJV and the Young's Literal Translation and the Darby Translation say ointment and perfume, so they say the oil is not olive oil that you eat, but rather that you put on your face and your hair. The American Standard Version and the Bible in Basic English say oil and perfume, which is the same as the NASB. So incense smells good, perfume smells good. Perfume is sweet-smelling stuff you put on your face. Incense is sweet-smelling stuff that you sniff. Either one is going to make the heart glad, and oil that you eat, like think about olive oil on bread. Oh my gosh, does that taste good? But even if you put it on your hair, you have to imagine that. If you were living in that culture, get the dirt out, that would make you happy too. So that sets up the second part of verse 9. A man's counsel is sweet. It makes somebody happy. Now there's a question as to who is made happy by this counsel. This wise counsel is understood. Let's look at some other translations. The translation I just read to you is the New American Standard Bible. So a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. So the sweetness goes to the friend. Here's the Holman Christian Study Bible. Oil and incense bring joy to the heart, and the sweetness of a friend is better than self-counsel. So now the sweetness comes from the friend back to the person giving himself counsel. So in other words, the counsel goes to the man himself, and the sweetness is said to come to the man himself. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible. Holman Christian Study Bible has the friend delivering the sweetness to the person receiving it, whereas the NASB has the man's counsel going out to the friend and the sweetness is going to the friend. So the sweetness is going in different directions depending on the translation. The Bible in Basic English says, "Oil and perfume make glad the heart, and the wise suggestion of a friend is sweet to the soul." Now the suggestion is coming from the friend, and the sweetness is coming from the friend to the principal. That's the same direction as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it. Actually, which way the sweetness goes is not really important. The point is that wise counsel is sweet. Okay, but that's not the end of the translation problems. There are alternate translations. The Holman Christian Study Bible says that it should be translated this way. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, but the soul is torn up by affliction, citing the Septuagint translation. That's how the Septuagint translates it. Instead of a man's counsel is sweet to his friend, or a man has a friend who gives him sweet counsel, instead of that we have the soul is torn up by affliction. The NAB actually adopts the Septuagint translation in the main text, the New American Bible. Perfume and incense gladden the heart, but by grief the soul is torn asunder. And if that were not enough translation issues, God's Word translates Proverbs 27:9 this way. Perfume and incense make the heart glad, but the sweetness of a friend is a fragrant forest. The God's Word note there at fragrant forest says that instead of fragrant forest, we could translate it is sincere advice. Well, amidst all those options, we'll just stick with the NASB. So a man's counsel is sweet to his friend. It's good to give good advice to people. How many times have you asked for advice or given advice? Now I'm 71 years old and people ask me for advice all the time. I'm sort of scared to give it, like what mechanic should you take your car to? Oh, I hate to do that one. And I've actually told people I will not give you investment advice because every time I suggest something, the company goes bankrupt. And I don't want you to be mad at me. But other than that, basic stuff, yes, ask for counsel and give counsel. Give wise counsel. It is important. Proverbs 27:10, Solomon says, "Do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother far away." Now let's start out our discussion of Proverbs 27:10 by saying that true friends are rare and are very, very valuable. And to forsake your own friend, your own true friend, and to forsake your own friend, your own true friend, is the stupidest thing that anyone could ever do. So don't do it. Now Solomon says, do not forsake your own friend or your father's friend. The generations are close enough to where you need to be friendly with your father's friends. I remember there was a lot of my father's friends that I was very nice to, just because they were my father's friends. And my father was an atheist, and most of his friends were not Christian, but I was still friends with them. Now, some other scriptures are reminiscent of this proverb. Proverbs 17:17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for a difficult time. A friend there is like a brother. Our proverb here in Proverbs 27:10 has a friend even better than a neighbor. Proverbs 18:24, a man with many friends may be harmed, but there is a friend who stays closer than a brother. Now here, a friend is better than a brother. In Proverbs 18:24 and in Proverbs 27:10, the friend is better than a brother. Do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother far away. Why would a neighbor who is not a brother be better? Here's what the pulpit commentary says. The mere blood relationship, which is the result of circumstances over which one has had no control, is inferior to the affectionate connection which arises from moral considerations and is the effect of deliberate choice. That's right. You can't choose your brothers, but you can choose your friends. And a lot of times your brothers are not nice people. Well, you can't stop being their brother just because they're not nice, but you can stop hanging around a person who is not a relative if they're not nice. And on the other hand, you can stay close to other people who are not related to you, and they're closer to you. They could be closer to you than a brother. Better is a neighbor. Now that neighbor is probably referring to the friend mentioned in the first part of the verse. Do not forsake your friend. Better is this friend or this neighbor who is near than a brother far away. Now the pulpit commentator has an interesting comment on this. Quote, the practice of polygamy with the separate establishments of the various wives greatly weakened the tie of brotherhood. There was little love between David's sons, and Jonathan was far dearer to David himself than any of his numerous brothers were. Think about David's two sons, Amnon and Absalom. Absalom killed Amnon. No love between those two. Jonathan was not related to David at all. He was in Saul's family, but he loved David. David loved him. There's an example. Friends closer than a brother. We don't hear of David being all that close to all of his brothers, but he was definitely close to Jonathan. We go now to Proverbs 27:11. Solomon says, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad, that I may reply to him who reproaches me. Now, there are plenty of scriptures about sons making their father glad, sometimes their mothers too, and not only talking about natural sons, but spiritual sons. Let's read them. Proverbs 10:1, a wise son makes a father glad. Proverbs 23:15, my son, if your heart is wise, my own heart also will be glad. Proverbs 23:24-25, the father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you. Proverbs 17:21, he who sires a fool does so to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy. So a good son produces gladness in the father's heart. A foolish son produces no joy. Proverbs 17:25, a foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her who bore him. Now let's look at some spiritual sons who make their fathers glad. 1 Thessalonians 2:19-20. Paul says, for who is our hope or joy or crown of exaltation? Is it not even you, you Thessalonians, in the presence of our Lord Jesus that is coming? For you, Thessalonians, are our glory and joy. 2 John 1:4, I was very glad to find some of your children walking in truth, some of the children of the church that John was walking to, just as we have received commandment. I was very glad, John says, to find his spiritual children walking in truth. 3 John 1:4, I have no greater joy than this, says John, to hear of my children walking in the truth. Proverbs 28:7, going back to natural sons, he who keeps the law is a discerning son, a wise son. But he who is a companion of gluttons humiliates his father. So what a son does will reflect on the father. And if one's son is foolish, then the father can expect reproaches. Solomon says in verse 11 here, be wise, my son, so that I may reply to him who reproaches me. Well, who's going to be reproaching the father? Well, the father could be blamed for begetting a foolish or uneducated son. And the father doesn't want to experience that. We go now to Proverbs 27:12. A prudent man sees evil and hides himself. The naive proceed and pay the penalty. That means the naive proceed right on into the evil, and they pay the penalty for it. So if you see evil, you need to hide yourself. What kind of evil? Well, it could just be the evil circumstances, trouble. But most probably, Solomon is talking about moral evil here. Stay away from it. This proverb, by the way, is a complete repeat from Proverbs 22, verse 3, which says, the prudent sees the evil and hides himself, but the naive go on and are punished for it. Those are both the NASB translations. I don't know why they don't translate it exactly the same, a little bit different, but it's basically, essentially, the exact same proverb. This reminds me of something that happened to me yesterday. I had a young Chinese woman, an accountant, who I led to the Lord years ago when she was my student, and she is on a chat group with some computer security experts. That's a nice way of saying it. I call them hackers. And they were working for Amazon, but they figured out how they could get in to a TurboTax Intuit TurboTax website, type in a code in the computer code, and all of a sudden a $105 TurboTax program only costs $5. And so my student, my former student, wanted to let me take advantage of that. And I thought about that, and I said, I'm not going to do that. But I played along with her for a while, and I tried to do it, and it didn't work. And so I called her up, and she says, oh, but it works for me, and blah, blah, blah. And finally, after we went through all that, I said, let me ask you something. I said, I was in China for a long time, and I know that Chinese ethics are somewhat, shall we say, sketchy. And she laughed because she knew it was true. I was in China long enough I could say that without fear of offending her. And I said, in fact, I remember when you were trying for a job interview and you were asked a question, and the question was to test your ethics, and you failed it, and you lost that nice, fancy job that was waiting for you because you cut some ethical corners. Maybe next time, and I said, I'll be dead while you, because she's still young, I said, I'll be dead, and you'll still probably be making a lot of money in your accounting career, and you'll be running up against a lot of opportunities to cut corners and to make money. Don't do it. Run from it. Hide from evil. I gave her a personal example. I was getting ready to invest in an IPO, which is a highly risky thing, but there was a possibility of a big payoff, and of course, I wanted to get rich. And so I was filling out the paperwork, and in order to put my investment into a certain hedge fund, you had to sign a document that the government required to prove that you were able to stand the risk. And it said, in order for you to enter into this investment, you need to have a net worth of $1 million. Well, I didn't have a net worth of $1 million. So I called up the man who was trying to get me to invest in this thing, and I said, I can't sign this because I don't have $1 million. And the man said, oh, that doesn't matter. Just go ahead and sign it. And like an idiot, I signed it. The result of that was is that everything went belly up. My family, not me personally, but me, my sister, my mother, lost over $1 million. The person who told me to go ahead and sign it is no big deal. He ended up in the federal slammer for 5 years. If I had just done the ethical thing and said, I can't invest in this thing because I can't sign this document. If I'd have just done that, I would have saved my family $1 million. Now, there's a story about how you should run from evil when you see it. She took that one to heart. I know that long after I'm dead, she's going to remember that story and not try to cut any corners. We go now to Proverbs 27:13. Take his garment. Take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger, and for an adulterous woman hold him in pledge. Now, this proverb is a little bit opaque. It's a near repeat of Proverbs 20:16, which says, take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger, and for foreigners hold him in pledge. Instead of adulterous woman, the NSB translates foreigners in Proverbs 20:16, adulterous woman in Proverbs 27:13. Same translation, different entity there. I'll get into the translation issues in just a moment. First of all, let's talk about a garment as collateral. What does it mean, take his garment? Here's one option, an option I don't agree with, suggested by Gill and Clark. The guarantor is in a risky position. When you become surety for a stranger or for an adulteress, there's a lot of risk there because foreigners can run, leave the country, and an adulteress is not likely going to be financially stable. So if you are backing up their debts, you're in a risky position. So you need to take surety from that stranger or from that adulteress, and the surety would be the garment. Well, that's nice, but I don't think that's what it means. I believe that this proverb is a prophecy of what will happen when the loan that is guaranteed goes bad. In other words, if you're going to guarantee a foreigner's loan or an adulteress's loan, you're going to have to pay for that loan when the loan goes bad, and you're going to have to pay for it with your garment. You're going to have to sell your garments in order to pay off the debt that you went surety on. Now, taking a garment as surety was legal. It was legal to keep until sunset, but then after sunset, the garment had to be returned to the debtor so the debtor wouldn't freeze to death. We read that in Exodus 22, verse 26. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. All right, now let's talk about sureties. This proverb implies that a surety is bad. Is this an absolute command not to enter into sureties? I don't think so. John Gill doesn't think so. Rather, it's an admonition to avoid rash sureties, sureties that are foolish from a financial point of view. Here's what Gill says, quote, it is a rash and inconsiderate entering into suretyship that is here cautioned against, doing it without inquiring into and having sufficient knowledge of the person engaged for, and without considering whether able to answer the obligation if required, without hurting a man's self and family. Otherwise, suretyship may lawfully be entered into and good be done by it, and no hurt to the surety himself and family. And I think Gill is basically right there, because the surety is a creditor, and there's nothing wrong with lending money. Nothing wrong with charging interest. And of course, in the Old Testament, you couldn't charge interest on a charity loan, but on a business loan, you could. There's nothing wrong with that, and a surety is basically, that's what he's doing. He's lending his credit. He becomes a creditor. He's lending his credit to another person. Well, here are my thoughts on how you can make a case for a sensible surety agreement. First of all, you rationally weigh out the risk. You know that you can stand the hit if the debtor can't pay the creditor. The debtor that you're standing surety for, if he can't pay, you've got to pay, but that's okay. You can stand it. The second thing you need to have is a good reason for being a surety. Perhaps the debtor is a family member and you want to back him up. Or maybe you're in business for being a surety, such as banks when they give out letters of credit. Letters of credit are often sureties. Well, the bank gets paid for it. Nothing wrong with that. Requirement number three, you will not expect to get paid back from the defaulted debtor. If you pay his loan, you have the moral right to request him to pay you back, but then you're putting him in debt. In my opinion, you're better left alone, not lending to friends, because basically going surety for a friend is putting that other person in debt to you because you are a creditor. You don't want to do that, so you would be willing to let the loan amount that was defaulted on, let it go, and don't ask it back from the debtor. Let it go as a gift. That's not Bible. That's just my personal humble opinion. Now, here's some other proverbs that Solomon has written in order to denigrate sureties. Proverbs 17:18, a man lacking in sense pledges and becomes guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. Proverbs 22, verses 26 through 27, do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from under you? In other words, if you guarantee a debt that's too big for you, then somebody's going to come after your stuff that you're going to have to sell in order to pay off the debt. Now, that proverb is opposed to situations in which the surety doesn't have money to pay the debt. It doesn't mention a situation where the surety does have the money to cover the debt. Proverbs 6, 1 through 3, my son, if you have put up security for your neighbor or entered into an agreement with a stranger, You have been trapped by the words of your lips, ensnared by the words of your mouth. Do this then, my son, and free yourself, for you have put yourself in your neighbor's power. Go humble yourself and plead with your neighbor. Because a surety is lending his credit to the person who made the loan that's being guaranteed, but that surety is also putting himself into debt to the person who lent the money to the surety. And it's a bad thing to be in debt, as anybody will tell you. Now, of course, you get into big discussions on this. What happens if you're in debt for your house and the value of your house is more valuable than the money you owe, so you could sell the house and pay off the debt, so you're not really in debt, you're just not liquid. I'll go along with that. I'll be loose on that. Unless, of course, you get upside down so that the mortgage is larger than the market value of the house, then you're in trouble. Then you are in debt. But I won't get into that except to say that avoid debt. The debtor is the slave to the lender. We all know that. Now we need to look at this word stranger. Take his garment when he becomes surety for a stranger. I just assumed that a stranger was a foreigner and he was a higher credit risk. Does that leave open the possibility that the surety could be a surety for a neighbor or a family member who is not a stranger, and therefore the risk would be less? I think so. Now, the second part of verse 13 says, don't give a pledge, a security agreement, a surety agreement, for an adulterous woman. Now, the translations are sort of split on that. Some of them say for a stranger, which would make the prohibition or the bad situation similar to the first part of the verse. Don't be surety for a stranger. Don't be surety for a foreigner or stranger. The second part of the verse. So if the translation says that, we don't have a problem. But there are a lot of translations who say an adulterous woman is who you shouldn't be a surety for. For example, the ESV says, take a man's garment when he has put up security for a stranger, first part of the verse, and hold it in pledge when he puts up security for an adulteress, the second part of the verse. And from that, I take it that both foreigners and adulteresses are credit risk, so don't be surety for them. Now, why would one be trying to back up the loan of an adulteress? Perhaps there's a long-term, ongoing relationship between the man and the adulteress, and she's got her hooks into him, and he loves her, and so she says, I need to borrow some money. Would you back me up? Would you be my surety? That's a bad credit risk for sure. What happens when the husband finds out? Now, one more word we need to look at in this verse 13 of Proverbs 27. The NASB translation says, and for an adulterous woman, hold him in pledge. That makes no sense to me. It really should be it. In fact, the Young's Literal translation has, take his garment, and for a strange woman, pledge it, the garment. The ESV says, hold it in pledge when he puts up security for an adulteress. It's the garment that's referred to, not the man. I can't imagine somebody saying, I'll put myself in slavery if my surety doesn't pay the debt back. I can't believe that. We go now to Proverbs 27, verse 14. Solomon says, he who blesses his friend with a loud voice early in the morning, it will be reckoned a curse to him. Now, I know how I would interpret this proverb. I hate getting awakened by a loud voice. I mean, I really hate it. Reminds me, I was teaching in China, and a lot of the young men in my class spent all night playing video games. Not studying, but playing video games, and they come into class, and they can't keep their eyes open. And so they put their heads down on the desk. Well, I have a rule that nobody puts their heads down on their desk while I'm talking to them. I consider it rude. And so when I see it happening, I would just stop lecturing. Of course, that grabs everybody's attention, and they watch me with bated breath as I walk back to the back of the room where said student is sleeping peacefully with his head on the desk. I slam my hand down on the table right next to his ear. He jumps up. You can see the startled deer in the headlight looks in his eyes. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know what's happened. And I say, son, if you want to sleep, there's a dormitory over there. You can sleep, but you're not going to sleep in my class. Oh, they hate that. However, that's not what this proverb is talking about. As John Gill says, the loud voice that's blessing the friend early in the morning, it's not necessarily waking him up. It just says early in the morning, he could still be awake, the man that's being blessed. But the idea is, Gill says, is the person coming in with this blessing is doing so in order to be heard by the friend and by others standing by. The blessing is pompous, hyperbolical, sycophantic, and flattering. Why? The blesser wants to be sure that no one preempts him in his attempt to gain by flattery. Or perhaps it means that this blesser, this flatterer, is going to be flattering from early in the morning all the way until nighttime. Well, if that's what the meaning is, if John Gill is right, I can understand why there would be a curse on such a man. Flattering one the whole day, that gets old in a hurry. At any rate, I believe that the point here is that excessive praise is bad, not high-volume praise is bad. We go now to Proverbs 27, verses 15 through 16. Solomon says, "A constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. He who would restrain her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand." Think about a drip dripping through a leak in the roof. You're in the house, you shut up, you can't get out because it's pouring down rain. Just like when you're married to a contentious woman who wants to fight with you all the time, you can't get out of the house, you can't go anywhere, you're stuck. And if you do leave the house, you're jeered at by those who know that you are a henpecked man, as John Gill points out. Now, there are lots of other scriptures that Solomon inveighed against this sort of a wife. Proverbs 19:13, "A foolish son is destruction to his father, and the contentions of a wife are a constant dripping." Proverbs 17:1, "Better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife." Proverbs 21:19, "It is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman." Proverbs 21:9, "It is better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman." Proverbs 25:24, a repeat of Proverbs 21:9. I guess Solomon wants to drive the point home, unless that's an editor's mistake in repeating the proverb. Now, this man trying to restrain his contentious wife, he might as well restrain the wind. You can't restrain the wind. It blows. You can't stop it. How about grasping oil with your right hand? You ever try to keep oil in your hand? It's going to drip out. It's hopeless. And it's hopeless to restrain a contentious woman. Grabbing the oil, as mentioned by Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, can mean to repress the aroma of perfume, which you can't do. I like the grabbing the oil better, watching it slip between your fingers. We go down to Proverbs 27:17, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Oh yes, that proverb is quoted all the time. A knife sharpener is usually iron or steel, so it's true that iron sharpens iron. It takes somebody tough to sharpen somebody tough. It takes a man to do that. Now, of course, I would apply this to women, too. One woman can sharpen another, but women are more sensitive. They might not like the iron. Of course, men don't like it either, but women especially, they're different. But the Lone Ranger Christian is not a paragon of virtue, is not an example for us to follow. We need other people to sharpen us up. Proverbs 27:18, "He who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who cares for his master will be honored." Application for this is take care of your boss. You'll get honored that way. Here's some other scriptures. This is when a man of God, a prophet, came to speak to Eli, the negligent priest in Shiloh managing the tabernacle, the time of the judges, 1 Samuel 2, verse 30, second part of the verse. "The Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed." So this is talking about God as the master. You care for God, he will honor you. John 12, verse 26, "If anyone serves me," this is Jesus speaking, "if anyone serves me," Jesus, "he must follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him." So you serve Jesus, God the Father will honor you. You might be meek, but eventually you're going to inherit the earth, and you might be persecuted because they hated the Master, they'll hate the Son. That's true. People might not honor you, but God your Father will honor you. We go now to Proverbs 27:19, "As in water, face reflects face, so the heart of man reflects man." If one hears the words and sees the actions that spring from deep within a person, then you will know that person. The man's heart will give you a perfect reflection of who he actually is. Just like you look into the water and you see that mirror reflection there, that will show you the reality of what actually is, what's actually causing that reflection. Now, of course, sometimes it takes a long time to see what's in a man's heart, but once you do, and that's why if you're married to somebody for a long time, you really know that person because you've had time to see what's in their heart. And that's why people that get married after 2 weeks are idiots.
Don't do that.
Proverbs 27:20, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, nor are the eyes of man ever satisfied. Sheol is the Hebrew word for death or the grave. Abaddon is the Hebrew word for destruction. So death and destruction are never satisfied. In other words, there's always going to be people dying and destroying themselves there. Right now, today as I speak, I read the news and I see people destroying themselves. I hate to see it. I hate to see it. But it happens every day, 24/7, never stops. It's been that way for all of history. Likewise, as the grave sucks up people always, never being satisfied, lusting for more corpses to be put in the grave, so are the eyes of man ever satisfied. They're never satisfied. They want more. They want more. They want more. Ecclesiastes 1:8, all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. I see something. I want more of it. I want more. I want more money. I want more power. As Adam Clark says, out of this ever unsatisfied desire spring all the changing fashions, the varied amusements, and the endless modes of getting money, prevalent in every age and in every country. The implication of all this is that people who lust after things of the world will be cast into death and destruction. I cannot tell you how many news articles I have read about internet influencers who've killed themselves, cast into death and destruction. The best example was one of a Swedish rock star, and I can't remember his name, but he had this song that was used as the theme song for a Reform podcast I was listening to, the Reformed Brotherhood or something like that, and it was about brothers. I remember that song. And so out of curiosity, I finally said, well, I'd like to listen to the whole song. It was used as the theme song for the podcast. So I got on YouTube and I looked, and doggone if that guy did not have over 1 billion downloads for that song. 1 billion! I mean, my podcast, as I speak right now, has 10,000. And I'm happy with that. This guy had 1 billion, and he committed suicide. The things of the world are not enough to satisfy. We go now to Proverbs 27, verse 21. The crucible is for silver and the furnace for gold. That's because in order to refine silver, you need a crucible to put the silver in so you can heat it up. And to refine gold, you need a furnace to put the gold in to heat it up. And each is tested by the praise according to him. All right, so people need to be refined too. They need to be tested. That's what tested means. It means to see whether it's good silver or bad silver, good gold or bad gold. You've got to heat it up. And so humans are tested by praise that are given to him. Now, that's interesting. How does praise test a person? Well, here are a couple of options. John Gill suggests that a person is tested by what kind of praise he receives. If the praise he receives is from good and virtuous people, then the receiver of the praise is also good and virtuous. However, if the praise is from evil men, then the receiver of the praise is evil. On the other hand, Clark and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown say, no, the man is tested not by the kind of praise that's received, but how the praised one receives the praise. If he is puffed up by the praise, he is worthless. If he is unaware of the praise, he deserves it. Now, I am torn between those two options. Either one is true. It could be both. If you get praised by good and virtuous people and you don't get puffed up by it, well, then you're tested. I would say both of those are true. We go now to Proverbs 27, verse 22. Though you pound a fool in a mortar with a pestle along with crushed grain, yet his foolishness will not depart from him. Solomon does not suffer fools gladly. How many proverbs has he written about fools? I'm not going to read them all to you. I will read you some scriptures from two Old Testament prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah, talking about how it's pointless when people are set in their foolishness and rebellion. It's pointless to try to stop it. Isaiah 1, verse 5. Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? In other words, rhetorical question. How many times are you going to be hit? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. You don't listen when you get hit in the head. Jeremiah 5:3. O Lord, do not your eyes look for truth? You have smitten them, but they did not weaken. You have consumed them, but they refused to take correction. They have made their faces harder than rock. They have refused to repent. Some people are just like that. They're fools. The foolishness will not depart, as Solomon says. Jeremiah 13:23. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? Then you also can do good who are accustomed to doing evil. Once people get stuck in their sin, it takes the irresistible grace of God himself to change that person. because humankind's sin is so deep and so pervasive and so extensive that man cannot save himself. And of course, this should remind us of Jesus' exhortation to not cast pearls before swine, because they will gobble up those pearls. They'll come and eat you. You have to be discerning. If somebody's willing to listen, you give them the gospel. Give them the truth. But if they're not willing to listen and they're going to continue with their stupidity, then don't argue with them. We go down to Proverbs 27, verses 23 through 27. Know well the condition of your flock, Solomon says, and pay attention to your herds, for wealth is not forever. Not even a crown lasts for all time. When hay is removed and new growth appears and the grain from the hills is gathered in, lambs will provide your clothing and goats the price of a field. There will be enough goat's milk for your food, food for your household, and nourishment for your female servants. Essentially, this is an elaborate proverb written by Solomon to continue his distaste with laziness. He says, know well the condition of your flock, pay attention to your herds. The flock is where the sheep are, the herds are where the cattle are. In other words, look after all the aspects of your agricultural enterprise. Why? Verse 24, because wealth is not forever. As Solomon said in Proverbs 23, verse 5, when you set your eyes on it, wealth, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies towards the heavens. Solomon also says that a crown does not last for all time. Anybody that reads history knows that's true. Kings come and they go, and they're usually not happy. The crown does not rest easy on a king's head. Verse 25, Solomon says, when hay is removed and new growth appears. And what that means is that if you'll just attend to your agricultural duty and remove the hay from the field, then that leaves room for new hay to grow behind it, and the cycle continues and people have food to eat. So stay busy cutting the hay as well as gathering the herbs and taking care of the lambs and the goats. As John Gill says, do your duty agriculturally and there will be wealth to follow. The lambs will give you clothes, the goats will give you food. Let me just read the last three verses again. When hay is removed and new growth appears and the grain from the hills is gathered in, lambs will provide your clothing and goats the price of a field. That means you will have so many goats you can sell some of them and have enough money to buy another field and grow some more crops. There will be enough goat's milk for your food, food for your household, and nourishment for your female servants. And with that happy prosperity message, excuse me for using that term, we are now finished with Proverbs 27, and we are ready to go in our next audio to Proverbs 28, which I will entitle The Proverbs of Solomon, Part 19. I hope you stay tuned for some more wisdom in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.